So? Oh no. Still 20 seconds. So you're very accurate. I've got 5 seconds. Hello, I think we're ready to begin. We start with a land acknowledgement. I'm Jonathan Oxhorn, Emeritus Professor of Architecture. That's not the land acknowledgement, which is as follows. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayukono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayukono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy predates the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayukono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayukono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. So the meeting is called to order. The first order of business is the approval of minutes from November 9th, 2022. And as per usual, this takes the form of unanimous consent since the minutes are a verbatim transcript of the meeting. So there ought not be any corrections. If there are, bring them to the attention of the Dean of Faculty. So our first order of business is faculty resources for student support and advocacy services. Julie Edwards, Director of Scorton Center for Health Initiatives, I believe is online. If you're there,
unmute. Yes, I am.
Begin.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. I would like to just share with you all some of the trainings that we currently offer, as well as a resource that we have online and something that we are considering. So if you can go to the next slide, please. First, and then the next slide, apologies. First and foremost, if you are not familiar, within the Scorton Center for Health Initiatives, we do focus specifically on offering notice and respond, assisting students in distress. And the main outcomes that we really look to achieve with the providing this training is to identify individuals in need of care. And so that aligns with our mental health framework. We want to provide a brief overview of Cornell student mental health. So we provide some data at the beginning. And then we review the various levels of distress and what you might notice in a student, and then really talk through the ways in which you may engage in conversation with that student and how you can make a warm handoff, and talking about the various resources that we have here at Cornell. And then lastly, we do highlight not only campus resources, but also local and national resources. And so these are currently offered at by request. And so we do try to offer at least several during each semester that are open to anyone. And if that is something that you would be interested in offering within your department, or if you would prefer that we offer some open ones for faculty interested, we would be happy to explore that piece. And the second slide, there's something also that, next slide. What we call our WISE program, or it stands for Well-Being in Scholarly Environments. And this was something that we piloted last year virtually, and then we actually offered something for CALS back in June. And we also provide in this session an overview of student mental health, but then discuss in detail the relationship between well-being and academic success, and then talk through different well-being promoting practices that could be incorporated into the classroom or just as you set the environment up. And that could be in syllabi, it could be the way in which you introduce yourself or have folks introduce themselves to one another, the students in your classes. And then we have small group discussions to really think through what ways might be easy to try and incorporate in the classroom in providing those supports. And then we debrief in a larger group. And we did receive really great feedback from the CALS group on this session. And so that is something that we're looking to explore ways in which we may expand upon this and offer this more readily to all of you if you are interested. And then one last thing I wanted to highlight, and if you could just go to the next slide, please. I think animations are in there. So it just shows how it aligns with our mental health framework. We do have a one-stop shop, or that's what we've been trying to show this as, and it's our mental health website. So if you go to mentalhealth.cornell.edu, at the top, you will see an area designated specifically for staff and faculty. And we have resources that currently exist there, including ways that you can support students with emergencies, urgent situations. It has various phone numbers and links. And then one new thing that we are exploring, it's been something that was in existence years ago, is my understanding, but there was a faculty handbook that highlighted a lot of different resources that were available to you all. And we are thinking through if it is helpful to revise something like this, where we could have it available online as well as hard copy, if you wanted it in your departments or within your offices. And so I'm working with the vice provosts to identify ways that we would be able to do this. But before we revise what we have, we really wanted to gather feedback from faculty members themselves. And so I'm working with the vice provosts to identify individuals who would be willing to provide feedback to inform the creation or the revision of such a document and how it may be helpful to all of you. And now what I would like to do is turn it over to Dean Love, who will talk about student support and advocacy services specifically. I wanted to highlight some of the existing trainings and resources, and I will now turn it over to her. And I'm not sure if Marla has joined. If she has not, I can just speak to it so we do not hold up the agenda.
Hello, Julie. This is
Yes.
Hi, it would be wonderful. Do you feel comfortable presenting?
Sure, that's totally fine. I'm happy to.
Thank you.
Sure. So the Dean of Students Office and Marla Love and her team, they've really worked at creating a referral form for students of concern. And I do know that there were, I believe, some changes that have been made recently. And so this form should be utilized for students experiencing non-crisis concerns, whether it's physical, psychological, or safety concerns. And you may refer them directly to our student support and advocacy services. So this terminology may be new. It was formerly called Care and Crisis Services. They've now rebranded the department in general. And this is the new link that you can use so that you would be able to go in and actually refer a student. You would select student of concern in the report dropdown, and then you would be able to put in information, and it would be received by the student support and advocacy services team with Marla and her team in general. And if you go to the next slide, I can share some of the concerning behavior examples. So if, for instance, there's someone who comes to you and they're having issues adjusting to college or making friends, if you see evidence of self-injurious behavior, if they're, if you're noticing intoxication or high risk substance use.
Hello.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought someone was speaking. Also, as far as, just aggressive speech, if there's suicidal ideations or erratic behavior that you may be seeing in students, whether in the classroom or around campus, if there are significant changes in academic performance and you're a bit concerned just because this is out of character for the student, wanting to get them connected, or also if a student has a weapon, and this is more of an urgent or emergent issue. And so these are some of just examples of the ways in which you can use the referral form, and then it would go directly to student support and advocacy services so that they would be able to really respond to the incident, try and navigate and help not only the student in general, but then also if there are supports that they can provide to all of you as faculty members. And so I wanted to stop there. She and I were just going to be sharing some of the overarching resources that we have available to all of you. And then I know that we were going to also open it up in the event that folks had questions or suggestions or considerations for us to explore.
Thank you. We now have time for about 10 minutes of questions or comments. If you're in person, step to the front, one of the microphones. If you are online, raise your digital hand. And we'll start with online, Catherine Caggiano.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation, Julie. I just had a quick question. I had just clicked through and was looking at the Student of Concern form. And there's one part of this form where it says involved parties and asks for sort of name and role, et cetera. And it's not clear whether we're supposed to be, for example, identifying ourselves or the student of concern. So I'm wondering, one, just which is it? And two, whether that perhaps can be made a little bit more clear on the form.
I appreciate that, Catherine. And it would be individual. So if it was a student or you know, a student might come to you about a fellow student. And so being able to identify that individual. But I think it's helpful to know that more clarity is needed. And so I'll make sure I take that back to Dean Love so that she can clarify that in the form itself.
Okay. So we're supposed to be submitting information about the students or students who's reporting, not ourselves.
Okay. Well, you can yourself as well. So if you're the one who is noticing the behavior, but sometimes there will be other students who come forward and so that you can also include their name there as well.
Okay. All right. Thank
yes,
you.
But I'll make sure to bring that to Dean Love so that she can clarify that in the form itself. I appreciate you bringing that up.
Thanks.
Sure.
Are there any further questions or comments? I don't see any.
Hi, Julie. We get emails into the Office of the Dean of Faculty where they are concerned about students and they feel like the resources are slow to act. And I was wondering if you could speak to what improvements have been made for time to treatment or time to seeing a doctor, if you know.
Oh, sure. So meaning slow to act from a Cornell Health standpoint? We have, just so that everyone knows, we have supplemented our in-person and telehealth within our CAPS department with also a telehealth provider called Mantra Health. And this has really helped reduce the wait times for students. The typical wait time for an initial visit is 1 to 3 days. And that's what our data is currently showing. Now, it may be adjusted now with the end of the semester. So I haven't looked at it recently, but about a month ago, it was 1 to 3 days. And the other piece is that we recognize that sometimes students, based on their schedule, may be offered an appointment that doesn't work for their schedule. And so we look at next available then. And so we do really try to work with students and offer either a CAPS appointment with our providers or with our Mantra Health. And originally we had just our after hours care so that we had a vendor utilized for after hours services. But this partnership with Mantra has really helped us so that we can mitigate concerns and get students in quicker than we were able to previously. And so I hope that helps answer, but it would be helpful if folks are experiencing issues with students being able to get in, if you would be able to share that information with us so that we can look at it in real time and then see if there are ways that we can make adjustments on our end as well.
Thank you, Julie. That's perfect.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay, I don't see any further hands up here or online. So I think we will move on to the next agenda item. We have a pretty packed agenda, so it won't hurt to save a few minutes here. The next order of business is a faculty update on student conduct and community standards. We have two speakers for 10 minutes, Christina Liang and then Karen Dix, followed by 10 minutes of questions and comments. So I don't know which of you will start, Christina, perhaps?
Sure, thank you. Hi, everyone. Thank you to Dean LaRosa for inviting us to this afternoon's Faculty Senate meeting. I'll just introduce myself and then I'll also pass it to my colleague, Karen. My name is Christina Liang, and I serve as the Director for the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards. Karen?
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Karen Vix, and I serve as the hearing panel chair in the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards.
Awesome. So we are both here today to provide some updates about the new student conduct process and to talk a little bit about how you all might consider getting involved with the university hearing and review panel. So we have a brief presentation and then we'll also, of course, reserve some time for questions. So whomever is helping us navigate the PowerPoint, if you can advance, thank you. And I apologize in advance. I have a lot of transitions. So if you want to click twice, that'll get us through the first couple of points. One more time would be great. Thank you. So just a reminder for folks who might not be as familiar with the conduct process, the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards is the office that's responsible for resolution of non-academic and non-Title IX behavioral concerns. So this would include any type of behaviors, including things like underage drinking, all the way to drug use, theft, disorderly conduct, and even things like hazing and physical assaults. And our office replaced the Office of the Judicial Administrator in July of 2021. And for those of you who have been here for a few years, you may have known that office to be the JA's office. So what folks from my team like to say now is JA no more, right? We've moved on to a different office, and Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards is our name. It's a mouthful. So the Student Conduct Office is a nice short version of that. And the new Student Code of Conduct and related procedures went into effect in August of 2021. So, we're in the second academic year of the new code and the new conduct office. Advance to the next slide, please. And then two more times. Thank you. One more time. Thank you. Oh, a little too far. Thanks. Okay. So, part of reimagining how Cornell addresses and resolves student conduct issues led to our team talking about our vision and our mission, kind of the why and what we do. So our mission here, if you don't mind clicking one more time, that I think that's not advancing properly. It's okay. You can go back one slide. Thank you. I'll just kind of talk about it. So our mission really is we want to take proactive prevention steps to help our students make good decisions. An example of that is, we now present to incoming first-year students at orientation, and we talk about community expectations in that presentation, talk about the impact of risky decision-making and how that impacts themselves and our larger community. Part of that is also we want to use a transparent, fair, and equitable student conduct process so that our students feel like the process is not happening to them, but rather that they can see the process as an opportunity to grow and learn from their mistakes. Also part of this is, we also considered envisioned creating an educational and restorative student experience for our students so that they can learn about both community standards and also their personal growth and development. The next slide, please. You've all seen this slide a couple of times at this point, but this is the conduct team. So very grateful that we've expanded our team, acknowledging that we added a whole bunch of residential spaces right on North Campus. And then also, of course, the Student Code of Conduct now applies to our social fraternities and sororities as well. Next slide, please. Thank you. And if you advance a couple, then yep, one more. Thank you. Oh, too far. I'm sorry. This is a learning moment for me. Next time, I'll just eliminate some of these transitions. So the new code of conduct, I think some highlights about changes is that it really creates an opportunity for my team to facilitate some prevention-based workshops and trainings. We like to say as a team, if we're invited to the space to talk about community expectations and help students make better decisions, we're happy to come and present on that. We've really departed from this like formal and punitive conduct process. We're trying to use more educational and equitable sanctions that involves the student's input, is recognizing that when a student is involved in the decision-making process, they tend to have more buy-in. And we're also providing robust training for our university hearing and review panel. And that's a big component of Karen's role. And that's a new role that's part of our team. So we're really excited to be able to do that as well. Next slide, please. I wanted to share a couple of excerpts from student reflective exercises. And so there'll be three examples on this page, and I'll just kind of share them briefly as, these are examples of things that students have shared as part of their, reflection papers or the things that they have said in the conduct process. So they've talked about how this experience has really taught them to always consider the reasons for why they're making decisions, and then to really weigh the risks and rewards And the compromises that they're making for their goals and why they're making them. And students have said, you know, in the future, I will put my opportunity for success first and weigh any decisions that I make with informed ideas about my own motivations and consequences. So really an example of a person applying what they learned in this process to future decision-making. Thank you. Other students have also said by hearing the interpersonal effects of my poor decision, as opposed to just the minimal financial dent that it has caused, I come away with a greater sense of responsibility for how I can support my community. So emphasizing the personal growth, but also how it impacts the broader community. And finally, this is very important, and I want to make sure I'm making a positive impact on my community and make up for the decisions that I did in the past. So it's great to see that students are reflecting on moving forward, how their behavior might change for the positive. Next slide, please. So a couple of themes I'll just share from our first year under the new conduct process is we're seeing reports involving behaviors that are kind of consistent with what you would see in a college environment. Some risky drinking, poor decision-making that's closely connected to that, things of that nature. We are seeing riskier behavior compared to pre-COVID-19. And so I think there's a sense of students wanting to make up for lost time, right? Engage in riskier behaviors, not necessarily having role models from the previous 2 years to kind of use as a model for them. There has been a rise in reports of cyberbullying and harassment behavior. And so that's definitely a trend that we're seeing as well. And there should be one more on the slide. Thank you. There's just been more reports in our newer residential communities, right? These are beautiful, shiny new buildings. And so lots of opportunities for students to engage in those spaces. And so we're seeing a rise in those reports as well. And with that, I'm actually going to turn it over to Karen, who's going to talk to you all a little bit about how faculty should consider joining our university hearing and review panel. It's a great opportunity. So I'll kick it over to you.
Thank you, Christina. So if what you've heard so far sounds like something you might be interested in being a part of, and you share some of those values of an educational and restorative student experience, then I invite you to consider joining the University Hearing and Review Panel. Next slide. So you may be wondering, what exactly is the University Hearing and Review Panel? So there are 55 people are a part of the University Hearing and Review Panel. There's 15 staff, 15 faculty, and 25 students. We resolve formal complaints that are reported to the Student Conduct and Community Standards Office. Participants and members of the University Hearing and Review Panel participate in paid approved monthly trainings. So the President's Advisory Committee on Diversity and Equity, and just an example of some of the trainings that would include, you know, some introductory. So you don't need to have any experience or any background in this type of work. So this is certainly an introductory training for those who have never done it. We've done trainings on identity and implicit bias and how you may show up as a decision maker, work with group behavior, sanctions and remedies, and of course, some practical applications in there as well. The term for participants and members is 2 years. It's staggered. So we had a group that joined last year and a fresh group that joined this year. So it's about half and half. Some will, their term will be up in May. And then we have some who have a 2 year term. So we're consistently looking for new members. And then one faculty member is selected to serve as a review panel chair for appeals. That person would be overseeing a three-person panel for appeals on some of the decisions that the original panel makes. So the appeals panel chair would basically oversee one faculty, one student, and one staff in making those decisions. Next slide. So if you know, we're looking for some folks who share some of the same values, the educational restorative values. There are, I think there's a couple more if you could just keep clicking. Yep. I want to let you know that I, as the hearing panel chair, I manage the administrative process of it. We have process and procedures that we have to follow according to the Student Code of Conduct procedures. So as chair, I manage those administrative pieces.
But I want to let you know this is a great opportunity to work with students and staff outside of the classroom, to be a part of just this brand new approach that we're using to address student behavior. The valuable insight that you get working with students, not just the ones on the panel with you, but also the students that are involved in the process too, and really getting a different perspective outside of the classroom, which is really just wonderful to be able to participate and engage with them as well. So I invite you to be on the lookout. We'll be doing a reach out. So if you're interested in that, you know, I'd certainly be open to hearing, you know, you can certainly reach out and contact me. I do want to acknowledge that we do have on our meeting today, we do have some people who served as chair and who have served on the hearing panel in the past. If you've done that, you're still welcome to join and be a part of it this year too. There's my plug, but I invite you to, you know, to continue the work and to join us. So I think we're ready for some questions. Oh, there's our contact information if you are interested in reaching out.
So we have some time for questions or comments. I'm looking for digital hands. If you're in person, just step to the front of the room. And I see Thomas Overton online.
Yeah, hi, Christina. Hi, Karen. You know, so and for the rest of the group, I spent several years as a hearing board chair in the former previous procedures. And I was just curious if you could comment on how the tenor of the proceedings has changed. You know, it certainly used to be quite contentious at different times and pretty difficult to work through in a number of cases. I was just curious how you perceive that the new procedures are going relative to the, again, the tenor of them.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Tom. I almost slipped and said Chair Overton because I've said that so many times. So first, thank you so much for your service for all those years. You know, I think one of the things that our community explored in the process of revising the Code of Conduct is acknowledgement that there were a lot of adversarial components to it. And, you know, while, you know, for us, I think this new Student Code of Conduct focuses on an opportunity to educate students and not focus heavily on pointing fingers and saying, you know, you did something wrong, right? For us, it's about moving forward and acknowledging that humans are not perfect, students are not perfect, but so long as we can be open to learning and growing from this opportunity, then there's benefit and growth from that. I'll kind of turn it over to Karen to talk a little bit more about the hearing process for sure, but I would say one of the really unique components about the new code is the explicit use of restorative justice in a lot of our resolution methods. And so we don't utilize the hearing process and the formal complaint process often. There are some times where it does happen, but we utilize things like mediation, direct referrals to encourage students to think about taking a decision-making class that is generally just a good practical skill, right? Outside of what happened in this particular situation, we use a lot of reflective exercises. We encourage students to engage in conflict resolution and de-escalating conflict. And all of that can happen outside of the hearing process. And that's been a great change of pace and change of tone for us.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
And I would add too, we have to acknowledge the human component of all of this, right? There is, with our students, I spend a lot of time working with the parties involved. I spend a lot of time working with the hearing panel and building that community and wanting to, be representative of our community and want to honor that too. So, I think that's something that has been an additional feature, with this new code as well.
We have an in-person speaker and then we'll go to Paul Ginsfarg after that. Go ahead and identify yourself, please.
Ashley Newman, College of Veterinary Medicine at large. My question was brief and just a point of clarification of if this office applies to not only undergraduate students, but also graduate students, professional students as well, and if faculty at all levels would also be eligible to serve. Thanks.
Yes and yes.
And I will add, we have some great representation from the School of Veterinary Medicine. We have some staff members that are involved. We have some students that are involved and have been wonderful, wonderful participants. So I encourage faculty as well. It's amazing.
Paul Ginsfarg online.
Thanks. I was curious about one thing that was on your slide. I apologize if you elaborated on it and I missed it. You had something about risky behavior having increased since pre-pandemic. And risky behavior may be some code word for something that you're familiar with, but I'm curious to know what it refers to. And you know, you said students were trying to catch up for lost time and what that means as well.
Sure. Absolutely. Happy to comment on that. I think, you know, thinking about our college students and the college age students in their developmental phases, right, they're looking to the collegiate experience to explore and try new things, right? And especially for the 2 years where students were largely being extra careful about, you know, things like socializing and partying, engaging in those types of behaviors, there's a component of wanting to kind of catch up. And so what I mean by that is we might see higher BAC levels, right? Blood alcohol content levels when students are evaluated and needing to be transported to the hospital because they're not knowing how to engage with alcohol in a way that is safe. And so that's what I meant by that. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah. Ordinarily going to parties wouldn't necessarily constitute risky behavior, but is there more than just alcohol that's being abused?
I think with every institution, there is potential drug use as well, but I would say largely our, my office experience is the reports that are coming to us largely stem from alcohol use and how it might affect decision-making.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions or comments? We have a few more minutes. If you have one, raise your hand or step up. Otherwise, not seeing any, we'll go to the next agenda item. This is the S.C. Johnson College of Business Tenure Clock Harmonization, Academic Freedom and Professional Status of the Faculty Committee Update. And we'll have two speakers. Initially, Suzanne Hsu for 10 minutes, who I believe is here in person. And then Tracy Stokel for 5 minutes, followed by 15 minutes for questions and answers. So Suzanne, why don't you start?
Thank you. Oh, is it working? Okay. My thanks to Eva and to the Senate for having us here today. I'm here serving as the Dean of Faculty and Research for the S.C. Johnson College. I'm also a professor in the marketing area at the Dyson School, affiliated with the Dyson School. So here to talk about the tenure clock harmonization. Thank you. And so a little bit of background. In 2012, the Johnson School Graduate School, which at that time was not yet part of the new College of Business, came and requested in front of the Senate an extension of their tenure clock from 6 years to 8 years. And that was driven by competitive pressures as well as some other reasons. And they did successfully get that change. It was changed with approval of the trustees as well. And so for the last 10 years, the Johnson School has been under an 8-year clock for our faculty. At the same time, once the College of Business was founded and brought together the three schools of Johnson, Nolan and Dyson were still under a 6-year clock for their faculty. And so we have this discrepancy within the college right now that some faculty are on an 8-year clock or so, and some faculty are on a 6-year clock. And that was a little bit of the concern that's prompting this. So why are we bringing this to you now? The college has been around for a few years at this point. Why is it suddenly an issue that we're asking for this consideration of an 8-year clock for all of our faculty? If we go to the next slide, in 2021, Dean Andrew Crowley, when he took over as the new dean for the College of Business, was the leader of a task force co-led with the provost to look at the structure and a lot of the processes within the college. And at that time, there were about 40 recommendations that were put forward, including some restructuring of how the faculty sat within the college. And one of the recommendations endorsed by the provost was to look at this question of tenure clock harmonization. And so that's part of why it's coming forward. But the other big thing that came out of that task force and the restructuring was a shift in how faculty sit within our college. And so if we could go to the next slide, the way to think about it right now is that our faculty now, under our new structure that just took over on July 1st, sit within 7 or 8 disciplinary areas. And so, for example, we have faculty in things like accounting or finance or marketing or strategy that sit within that disciplinary area and teach across our 3 schools. So faculty are still affiliated with a school, which is where the majority of their teaching happens. And yet we also have faculty who teach in multiple schools at the same time. What is the implication of this for the tenure clock issue? Well, if you think about one of our disciplinary areas like finance, you can think of this as similar to a department in other parts of campus. When we are hiring new faculty into finance, let's say that we go out onto the market like we are this year, hiring some new faculty from a pool of rookies who have just completed PhDs in other business colleges, and we hire one finance faculty member as an assistant professor to affiliate with the Johnson School and another finance faculty to affiliate with the Dyson School, they're effectively teaching the same courses, they come from the same pool of candidates, they're doing the same research and have the same expectations, and the tenure vote will be of the other faculty in their area, which would be the other finance faculty. And yet, the one affiliated with the Johnson School has an 8-year clock, and the one affiliated with the Dyson School would have a 6-year clock. And that's the piece that concerns us, is that there's sort of an inequity and an inability to compare those two faculty members when they're coming up for tenure, because they're living under different expectations in terms of the time that they have, even though everything else they're doing is essentially the same. And that's part of what is motivating us to come forward now and ask for this to be reconsidered. We would like all of our faculty to be following the same basic tenure clock for evaluation. So if we go to the next slide, the proposal to move forward, Dean Crowley appointed a committee led by one of our faculty, Sachin Gupta, and with representation from all 3 of the schools. So faculty who had been tenured under either a 6-year or 8-year clock, who had been experiencing those different tenure clocks. And so equal representation across our 3 schools. That committee looked at all of the options. They spent a lot of time considering the pros and cons of a 6-year clock versus an 8-year clock. They included information from peer schools, and I'll mention some of that in just a moment. They also did a lot of town halls with our existing faculty and surveys to try to understand the different trade-offs that our faculty saw on what was preferable. They also looked at some historical data on tenure cases and delivered a very comprehensive report to us in April, which I think was provided as a preview to this meeting. There was then a vote of the faculty, an official vote of faculty held in September. Dean Crowley and I have also gone and presented to the Provost Council, to the Academic Dean's Meeting, and to the AFPSF, which you'll hear Tracy present in a moment, that report, and the UFC. So we've sort of been going around getting feedback all over campus on this particular proposal. And so just to take you through a few of the things that are part of our consideration and also what happened with that faculty vote, if we go to the next slide. For background, part of the original recommendation 10 years ago of why the Johnson School wanted to go to an 8-year clock was very much driven by competitive nature of our peer business schools. And you see that here, this is an updated updated set of data for the peer business schools that was put together for this report. And you'll see that a lot of those other top schools have more than 6 years as a tenure clock for their business school faculty. And the reasons for that are varied, but for our purposes, what we're concerned about is that we are hiring against those schools and our faculty are being drawn away by some of those other schools. And so it's a competitive matter for us that to get good faculty and to keep good faculty and retain them, we need to be competitive in terms of our tenure clock. And in the business school environment, if you talk to any junior faculty member who's assistant professor on the tenure track, they will tell you longer is better. That's what they want, is a longer tenure clock. So it's very difficult for us to compete against these other schools that have longer clocks. And you see that the other thing we've highlighted on this is other universities, sometimes the business school or the business college is out of sync with the rest of the university by having that longer clock. So just to let you know that that is sort of a typical thing that happens. If we go to the next slide, the recommendations that came out of the committee report, the first recommendation was the really big one, which was to convert everybody over to an 8-year clock. And I'll show you some of the pros and cons for that in just a moment. What the report was less clear on was the midterm review timing. Should it be after 4 years or after 5 years? Again, with the peer schools, there's a little bit of difference on which pattern those schools choose. The other recommendation that came out of the report was that whatever the timing of that midterm review was for our assistant professors, it should be very comprehensive and thoughtful, and not just be sort of an automatic pass-through to continue with the appointment, but to really think about where does this faculty member stand. If they are not on track for tenure, we need to be honest about that at that point in time, because 8 years is a long time to have someone who's perhaps not being productive. On the other hand, if we have a faculty member who's really a superstar and doing fantastic, and we have some risk of them being poached away from another university, then we need to consider options like promotion to associate professor without tenure at that midterm review. So that was part of the set of recommendations that came out of the report. Something that we're still trying to figure out what the best option there is. What, you know, for example, what is the split of faculty that would get the associate without tenure versus just assistant and so forth. So we realize that there's some trade-offs there, but really the big one is that 8-year tenure clock. If we go to the next slide, the list of pros and cons for that 8-year tenure clock, I don't want to read all of these. They're documented very well in the report from the committee, but just to highlight a few of them, numbers 2 and 3 are all about retention. And that's something that we take very seriously. When we go back and look at the numbers, especially for women faculty, which have a difficult time, to be honest, in business schools and business colleges in terms of getting tenure and staying in the pipeline, this longer clock really helps them out. We get a lot of feedback from them that this is something that's very important to them and becomes a real retention issue, that if we don't have a longer clock, they will leave us for other top business schools that do have longer clocks. The midterm review, as you see, shows up in there in a few spots. The other aspect, number 5, hiring rookie faculty. We're doing a lot of hiring right now. As I meet with those rookie faculty to talk about coming to Cornell, the question of tenure clock comes up in almost every conversation, and they are pretty unanimous about the fact that they all prefer a longer clock, that that is something that they are really paying attention to when we're trying to recruit them. And then number 7 is another one that I think is really important here. Since we are in this college with the 3 schools, we have 1 school with an 8-year clock and 2 schools with 6-year clocks, and those faculty are all doing very similar work, publishing in similar outlets, in the same discipline, doing similar teaching, and we feel the need to harmonize. The question is, which direction do we harmonize? We're very concerned that if we ask the Johnson School to convert that down to a 6-year clock, that sends a really negative signal to our competitive set compared to, again, I showed you all those peer schools, versus if we move the Nolan and Dyson schools up to an 8-year clock, that sends a positive signal of who Cornell wants to be as a business college and who our competition is. And so the last slide to put up, if we can switch, just the results of the faculty vote. I wanted to show you those. This was the official faculty vote that we took in September. We have 149 tenured or tenure track faculty in our college. About 70% of them responded. Pretty representative in terms of area and school. The vote on the 8-year clock, very positive. About 80% were in favor of that 8-year clock. If we break that down by school, you'll see that Johnson is overwhelmingly positive, 93%. Of course, they've had that 8-year clock for 10 years now. They really like it. Dyson, also positive. Nolan, still majority support, but not quite as strong as Johnson. The timing of the midterm review I mentioned is something that's still sort of unsure to us. We see pretty equal split between faculty who like it after 4 years versus after 5 years. And so that's something we're still sort of thinking about, but the 8-year clock is certainly the big piece that we're looking for feedback on. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Okay, and is Tracy online somewhere? Can you unmute yourself?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Thank you. So I represent the Committee of Academic Freedom and Professional Status of the Faculty, and we reviewed the original document provided to us from the College of Business. And then we met with Dean Hsu, and we had a great discussion. And Dean Hsu provided us with additional information, which we incorporated in our final report. So essentially, We evaluated the proposal, and we think it's really important to standardize and harmonize the clock at the College of Business, for the reasons that Dean Xu articulated, in that faculty pretty much performing the same job are now evaluated on different clocks. Although the 8-year clock is much longer than the rest of the university, it is in line with a lot of the College of Businesses, which are 7 to 8 years in those that were surveyed by Dean Xu. And that would fit within the expectations of a College of Business. And as Dean Xu indicated, most of the new faculty that are hired into the College of Business are hired into the college and don't fit within the classic school structure, but may actually span multiple schools within the College of Business. So we thought that there were several pros to the proposal, and that they do want to harmonize it, and that the majority of the faculty were surveyed in the more recent survey, which was 79%, as indicated by Dean Xu, preferred the 8-year to the 6-year clock, and that the pre-tenure assistant professors would be given the option to stay on their current clocks under the current proposal. So they could choose to stay on their six-year clock or go to an 8-year clock if they're currently in the Dyson College or the Nolan School. So what were some of the issues that we raised? We felt that the issue that the tenure vote would be more informed because there's an 8-year or at least a 7-year time for evaluation for that faculty, where the faculty member may have accumulated more citations, and that would be inform a better faculty vote for tenure, was not unique to the College of Business and actually affects a lot of other colleges and units at the university. And so we didn't think that was the strongest argument. However, again, we understand that that is part of the culture of the College of Business, and that the majority of faculty, including many of the assistant professors who are most impacted by the change, preferred an 8-year versus a 6-year clock. We were concerned about the female faculty, particularly female faculty have more of an inclination because of family concerns or family desires to request extensions on an already extended clock compared to the rest of the university. Dean Xu provided us with information showing that both male and female faculty can request parental leave and tenure clock extensions. And interestingly, more male and female faculty have actually requested these tenure clock extensions. And that may be because many of the female faculty haven't had families. And data provided by Dean Xu indicates that the extension of the clock may actually facilitate tenure rather than because the percentage of women getting tenure within the College of Business or the different units in the College of Business were quite low, concerningly low. And since the Johnson Graduate School has changed to an 8-year clock, that proportion has increased from around, I think, 20% to closer to 60% for women receiving favorable promotions and tenure. The effect of the extension of the clock on minorities was not addressed, and that's because minorities represent a fairly low proportion of the college and are primarily Asian. Our committee was most concerned about the voting results from the Nolan School, where only 61% of the faculty voted in favor of it. And when discussed with Dean Xu, she indicated that comparative peer schools actually mostly have a 6-year clock. But data provided by Dean Xu showing that when faculty have left Cornell to go to other schools, they're not going to comparative schools to the Nolan School of Hotel Management, but are really going to the College of Businesses, so actually going to a more extended clock anyway. So the last point I wanted to make is that we felt that even though if faculty are not given the option of early promotion to an associate professor without tenure, that it may send a negative signal to faculty that are still performing acceptably, but that because most of the peer schools seem to offer that option, we felt that that should be a consideration at the College of Business if they adopt the 8-year clock.
We can't hear you.
You can't hear me?
Okay, you're back.
Okay, great. Sorry, I sometimes lose internet here. And we felt that that may place Cornell at a disadvantage if early promotion to an associate professor without tenure was offered. So to summarize everything, we felt that it is important to provide uniform expectations for tenure, regardless of whether it's a 6 or 8-year clock. And we acknowledge that the vast majority of faculty prefer the 8-year clock. And that's it for me. And hopefully I didn't go over time.
It's okay. We have some slack time. Are we ready for questions and comments? If you're in person, step up to one of the two microphones. If you're online, raise a digital hand. And I'll wait a few minutes, seconds, not minutes. We have someone in person, I think. So just identify yourself. And
Tom Fox from Molecular Biology and Genetics, appointed in CALS. And so if I understand this correctly, there will be faculty members with CALS appointments in Dyson who are on a different tenure clock from the rest of the faculty members in CALS, which personally I don't see as a problem at all. And the reason I'm asking the question is folks in my department years ago talked about how it would be better to have a longer tenure clock. And we were essentially told, well, you just can't do it. It's got to be uniform in a college. So does this actually open the door for other units to make similar extension requests? That's my question.
It's a wonderful question. And as a faculty member in Dyson, I'm very appreciative of the fact that Dyson is a unit that is managed by the College of Business, and so we welcome the fact that we have that history. But you're right, a faculty member coming into Dyson would now have an 8-year clock under this arrangement. Whether this is something that other units should consider, I think that's outside of my realm of expertise. I think it's a fair question, but not one that I can answer today.
Tracy, do you have any responses to that question?
So I will say that we didn't discuss that in the committee, and I think largely because we felt that this would not be something that most of the colleges would go for or other units in the university. But if we're wrong on that aspect, and this is creating precedent for a vast move by colleges, they would have to justify it pretty well by showing that peer schools do the same thing so that Cornell would remain competitive. And I know for my college, at any rate, that would make us very uncompetitive and we have a hard time competing anyway. So I think that there's a lot of colleges I know that would not want to move to at 8 o'clock. So I don't foresee this becoming a wave of requests to the provost to change the clock. It would have to be adopted by the Board of Trustees. So at this stage, it's fairly unique to the College of Business and the business school initially.
I'm not seeing any other hands raised. So at this point, I think we will move on to the next agenda item, which is announcements, updates from the Dean of Faculty, Eve DeRosa, and Kelsey Specht, Associate Dean of Faculty. So you have lots of time. Talk slowly.
Drop things,
that helps.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for attending. So first thing that I would want to announce is we have sad news that Cynthia Robinson, who has been supporting the Cornell Academics and professors emeriti committee, executive committee, and the work of all the retirees and the faculty and the RTE. Is retiring after 40 years at Cornell, which is phenomenal. CAPE, this committee, has actually only existed 40 years, so she's been here from the very beginning, not in that role, but the longevity is really amazing. And also the work that Cindy did, she just gave all parts of herself to this job. It's been an honor to work with her. She's amazing. So it's really sad news for the Office of the Dean of Faculty. She's been there for 13 years, and so we will miss her. We will miss her vivacious energy. And this is a picture, and I think Cindy will probably cringe at this, but we thought it was pretty funny to include a picture of when the day that she received the President's Award for Employee Excellence. She's considered a game changer by the university, by the president, and she really is. She supported the emeriti and the retirees through the pandemic. She was a person who, at a time, it was really difficult to get vaccinations, and she was really looking all across the state, getting people to vaccinations. Still makes me emotional. So we will miss you, Cindy, and thank you. Next slide, please. And I have to say, Dean Hsu, this is probably the least contentious presentation for the business school. So thank you for efficient presentation, very thorough. As Dean Hsu was presenting to the AFPSF, the UFC, some phenomenal questions from both of those committees, and the business school will go back and collect the data, and really has been able to put forward a compelling proposal. So I would now want to remind, or those of you who did not see this article, the president has a new task force on undergraduate admissions. And we had a, under Charlie Van Loan, when he was the Dean of Faculty, he created an advisory committee on undergraduate admissions at the university as Senate committee, advisory committee. And so once the president made this choice to have her own task force on admissions, we wanted to make sure we had faculty representation on that. And it's very good representation. There was an article in the Chronicle. You can see who's on it. And it's a growing committee, but only by one or two more. So essentially, it's the full committee. And we have 9 faculty members. And one of the faculty members is a senator representative on the University Faculty Committee. One's a non-senator representative on the University Faculty Committee. And Alan Matthews is playing non-senator role, but also he was the chair of the Faculty Senate's committee, Advisory Committee on Admissions. That group, if you looked at their annual reports, Charlie convened this group just before he stepped down from Dean of Faculty, and that group met 3 or 4 times. You can look at their annual report, and every time they met with Vice President of Admissions and Enrollment, John Burdick. And so they are extremely well-versed on all of the complexities and nuances that are involved in the decisions about admissions. And so our committee and our Senate is sending great representatives, and I think very valuable representatives, to the conversation at the university level. And so I also wanted to mention that we have good representation across the colleges. And so you can see that 6 of our colleges that admit undergraduates are present in the committee, in the task force. Next slide, please. So actually, we have ample time, so we can actually even open the discussion up even more. But we have, in the good of the order, Carl Frank today is going to present a pending resolution that came to the UFC and will be on our first Senate meeting in the new year. And so that's the Academic Freedom in Cornell Programs in China and other parts of the Global Hub system. And so they'll present today the initial resolution as it is, and it's an opportunity for more faculty to
become a part and sponsor, co-sponsor this resolution. Another resolution that's coming to the Senate in the very first meeting is the need for a gynecologist, a medical doctor in Cornell Health. They do not have one. And this is a resolution that has passed the student assembly, the graduate and professional student assembly, has been under consideration and may even at this point have passed in the university assembly. And so we're the only assembly that has not considered it. And so we'll bring it to the Senate in the new year. Other resolutions that I anticipate, and I know there will be more, but at the moment, we will be looking at, and we brought this topic already, the reactivation of the research scientist title for researchers that are contract-based researchers at Cornell, so part of our RTE faculty. And the complexity with this and why it hasn't come is that we have to create a new description of a research scientist and also think through the implications of if we do this, because this is a title that was taken away from faculty in the departments and units where you can get tenure. If we do this outside of the research divisions, then we have to first consider the people who currently have the title and how they either meet or don't meet the new description of this title, and also the implications for our RTE that would like to have the title. And I think there's a good energy behind it and it will happen. And so the current proposal will have research associate and senior research associate, research scientist and senior research scientist, and then research professor at the three stages. So that looks like where we're going with that. Another anticipated resolution. So the physical education committee has been meeting. They've been meeting with all elements, their dean of athletics, we have a new dean of athletics, the provostial sort of responsibility of athletics. And then, of course, the committee itself, the Senate committee. And it's been a very contentious and complicated conversation about whether we should eliminate the swim test. And so I believe they've come to resolution and they'll be writing it over the winter and we should expect it in the early spring. And the RTE task force that Charlie convened in his final year as dean of faculty is still going strong. And in fact, we're meeting on Friday and we're still working through sort of issues of representation, equity, and inclusion, and we'll formalize that in some way also for the spring. And I think that is it. Chelsea, I don't know if you want to speak to what you're doing at the... So we are having a cocktail party afterwards. So those of you who are on Zoom land, please feel free to come down and physically be in person, have a drink and some food with us. And I don't know, Chelsea, if you want to speak to... So we're really trying to increase our faculty engagement. And so Chelsea's come up with an innovative sort of way to get our senators to think of themselves as serving on some of our Senate committees.
It's an innovative bribe. So, again, if anyone from Zoomland is on campus and can come here, and then obviously everyone here, we have a room outside of here to have a celebration cocktail hour after the Senate meeting is over, and you will be able to one of the things that I've noticed is that we just met with the chairs of all of the Senate committees today and had a really nice lunch, and one of the things that was so amazing is to hear the chairs talk about their committee work, and each one of them said, I'm on the best committee because we get to do this. Like, well, I'm on the best committee because we get to do this. Well, I'm on the best. And they were so inspirational the way they talked about the work that they all got to do. And they're not all faculty Senate members, right? They're just members that are parts of these committees. But you all, as members of the faculty Senate, can also serve on these Senate committees. And it can really increase your understanding of the breadth of work that is done and also enable you to be on one of these best committees to be on. This includes the A.D. White, selecting who are our A.D. White visitors. It includes selecting what music choices we get to listen to through our amazing concert series, as well as impacting some of the most important work that we do with our with fellow faculty, with research, with graduate students and undergraduate students. So this is an opportunity for you to sign up for one of these committees. There's information about each of the committees and what they do. And you'll get the opportunity to take a piece of paper, put your name on it, let us know which committee you'd like to be part of, and then put your name into a little bag. Is it a bag, Jill? Or it's a basket, into a basket. After we get a number of names in that basket, we will then start pulling those names, and we have some beautiful Cornell swag that you will then get to win. But you can only win if you put your name in the basket. And you can only put your name in the basket if you want to be on one of the committees, which are all the best committees to be on. So, yes. Well, that is a very good point. My sense is what you should do is let us know what committee you're already on. And then let us know if there's any other committees that you might also want to be part of. Or, because we want you to be happy in where you are, or if you want to re-up to be on that committee, just let us know now. You can also say, actually, you know, I'm kind of done, but I am on this committee, so you get to put your name. I think you should get to put your name in if you're already on. So thank you very much.
So we have a number of members of the University Faculty Committee who are here and online. So we have a few minutes for questions if needed or wanted, and then I think we'll move on. Okay, great. So we will then have Carl come on up. We'll start the good of the order, and Carl will present this new resolution. And then we have time for discussion, and then maybe we'll end early today and start our holidays soon.
Thanks very much. I'm Carl Frank from Physics. And Jill is thank you for putting up the our resolution. So we'll be showing you this, and I'm going to ask you to just take a look at it and read it. We'll have it's a brief resolution, but it's posted on the pending, as Eve explained, is on the pending website. So the border is here. What I mean by that is the international border is right where we stand here. And flawed people can do the right thing. I'm exhibit A of that. This week was a crazy time. I was engaged in promoting this resolution. And did some pretty dumb things. And I want to thank Eve for classy reactions that gave me a chance to talk to you about this. Also, I want to explain I'm not an originator of this resolution, but as soon as I heard about it, I knew it was something that we really needed. And I really, it's an honor to say something about it. Also, as we speak, more people are joining on as sponsors. So as I show here, the resolution has words about Cornell's programs in various places, international programs, with a special emphasis on China. Could I have the next slide, please? If we can jump to the next slide. Oh, thanks. Sorry, the second one is what I wanted. Okay, so the point is here, it's a question of how a concern has come up, and it's a question of how Cornell looks upon itself in the world. We have some fantastic arrangement with around the world in the sense that we bring people here. We have a global reach. They get educated, we learn from them, and they go back out. And all happens in Ithaca. But I'm reminded of something that my wife and I learned about last week. We went to the lecture by Melissa Moore, who's one of the chiefs of Moderna. And she had explained to us that, in a sense, we can thank our lives, a lot of us can thank our lives for the fact that very, very quickly, the Wuhan virus got sequenced, and the data was posted by Chinese scientists that allowed the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines to immediately get to work on doing something that was absolutely wonderful and historically life-saving. So in that sense, you might as well have been in Wuhan when you got that sequence. What I mean is the data was presented instantly around the world, life-saving help that allows us to get a vaccine. At the same time, there's a lot of things that are going on that are very disturbing in the world. The war in Ukraine, the behavior of Saudi Arabia. At the same time, there's optimism in Iran and the heroic efforts in favor of human rights. These are tremendous developments, but the United States doesn't always do the right thing. And that's my point about doing flawed things. I just remember hearing about a wonderful couple that fled from Russia, husband and wife. They were physicians. They showed up on our southern border, and they were thrown into despicable camps under despicable conditions. And this is the kind of thing that a lot of people who are less attractive couple than this freedom-loving couple from Russia get thrown into, folks from Central America, for example. So what is our reaction to all this? As you know, in many cases, it's not my problem. You just go about doing what we need to do and carry on. But there's been a tradition at Cornell of looking beyond what's our immediate interest in the future. And I want to circle back to something that happened lots of years ago that had a lot to do, that connected to Cornell to China. It was a time when I was walking decades ago past Bartels Hall, and there was a fantastic array of satellite dishes. That's the way you get the news out in those days. And it was there because Frank Rhodes, our president, had gotten ahead of the U.S. State Department in a matter of foreign policy, just like Joe Biden got ahead of Barack Obama on gay marriage. It was because the former president of Taiwan was giving a keynote address at his alumni reunion, and that happened to be here at Cornell. So, well, Seneca said to me, you know, Cornell, Frank got a big donation out of that, but I don't think that's what's happening there. I think this is a matter of principle. Now, we began our meeting with your reading, thank you, Keen Oxford, of a statement of principle regarding Native Americans here. And what I'm offering to you today is this, what I think is a beautifully succinct resolution. It really gets right to the heart of the matter. A couple of springs ago, when we tied ourselves here in the Senate in knots, trying to address this issue of international relations of China with regards to a shared program, and we now have a chance to do it again. Now, the important point I want to make is that when you're dealing with an autocracy, any institution worth a darn is going to be an arm of that autocracy. So we're working with the Chinese government. So what this resolution is about is very simple, and you could read it. And if I can get to the next slide, please. These are the co-sponsors and growing as we go along. And if I can have the next slide one more time, you can find out what's going on about this. And we hope very much that you'll take a look at this resolution. I hope you'll debate it. We're having fierce debates in my department, but importantly, I hope you'll support it because I think it really needs to get done. So to circle back, I've tried to offer examples of how we move along clumsily, my case in point, but at the end of it all, despite our foibles, we can get to a better place and without being pretentious about it and make this wonderful and make this wonderful solution institution I'm so lucky to belong to better together. Thank you for your time.
So Eve, do we want to take questions and comments or okay?
Sure. Since we have time, we can take any questions or comments. And I did forget to say, sorry, Carl, we will send this resolution to the Committee for Academic Policies and Procedures. The chair of that committee sits on the International Council. So we can also do what we did, like we did with Tracy, giving a committee review of the proposal along with the co-sponsors in the next Senate meeting. So I meant to mention that. But please, anyone online or in person.
I think we are done and ready to adjourn. See you next semester or in the adjacent room for a party if you're here.
Thank you. Hope you stay.